Want a chance to win 250 pounds in vouchers? All you have to do is fill out the Ballpark's listener survey. It takes just 15 minutes. The Ballpark podcast is celebrating our 10th anniversary in 2026. And after more than 130 episodes covering U.S. politics, we want to hear from you to shape our next decade. So hit the link in the show notes for the survey details and prize draw terms and conditions. Share your thoughts, and you could be 250 pounds better off.
Hello, and welcome to The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan U.S. Center here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan U.S. Center's blog on U.S. politics and policy, USAP. From the rise of Donald Trump in the U.S., Brexit in the United Kingdom, and Viktor Orban in Hungary and National Rally in France, anti-system populists have seen a resurgence in many Western democracies in the last decade. In his new book, After the Fall, From the End of History to the Crisis of Democracy, How Politicians Broke Our World, Professor Ian Shapiro of Yale University, and a current visiting professor at the Phelan U.S. Center, looks at why voters in these countries have become disaffected, and how the policies adopted by elites following the end of the Cold War have allowed populism to flourish. In January 2026, I spoke to Professor Shapiro about his new book. Our conversation covers how the 2008 financial crisis and the collapse of inclusive economic growth has led to the growth of populism and a crisis of democracy. We also discuss the US's turn away from democracy promotion and Trump's America First policies. Our conversation also covers how political and economic elites must prioritize inclusive growth, which can help to restore democratic legitimacy. I began by asking Professor Shapiro to outline his research and current work.
My name's Ian Shapiro. I've been a political scientist teaching at Yale for over 40 years, working largely on questions of democratic theory and politics. Particularly in recent years, I've been, like many others, trying to understand the sources of the struggles of democracy all over the democratic world and what might help us alleviate some of those struggles.
Thank you. So your upcoming book, After the Fall, From the End of History to the Crisis of Democracy, How Politicians Broke Our World, aims to explain the rightward turn of global politics since the end of the Cold War. Can you talk about how this turn has played out globally since the end of the Cold War?
I think that underlying all of the changes in the rightward turn has been the disappearance of inclusive growth, by which I mean economic growth, the benefits of which are widely shared among the great majority of the population within these countries. And I think this has two principal sources: decisions made by center-right parties and decisions made by center-left parties. I think the center-right parties was the embrace of neoliberalism at the end of the 1970s, beginning of the 1980s, under the slogan, as Margaret Thatcher famously put it, "There is no alternative, Tina." This was partly because Keynesian policies had successfully been blamed for failing to deal with the stagflation of the 1970s, and that created the opening for neoliberals who had been lurking in think tanks for decades to be mainstreamed by Reagan and Thatcher, principally in the UK and the US, but their lead was followed on much of the continent. And I think that the left was very much on the back foot because of the apparent failures of Keynesianism. And so the center-right seized the opening. But that's only half the story. The other half of the story is the extent to which center-left parties bought into the Tina idea through the doctrine famously associated with Bill Clinton called triangulation. And so this was the notion that became stronger and stronger as communism started collapsing, getting into deep trouble in Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, the sort of twin blows, if you like, of the discrediting of neo-Keynesianism and then the collapsing fortunes of communist economies caused the center-left parties to decide that the way to get power was to be more Catholic than the Pope. And so you would see things like Mitterrand's about turn, his abandonment in the 80s of his socialist policies, firing of the socialists in his cabinet and buying into austerity politics henceforward. You see New Labour in the UK. You see the New Democrats in the US. in Germany. It's a coalition of, it's not the CDU, it's a coalition of the Greens and the Social Democrats in the first decade of this century who implement the Hartz reforms, which are the pro-business equivalent of what New Labour was doing in Britain and what the New Democrats were doing in the US. And so the center-left parties buy into the TINA agenda and just claim to be more competent technocrats than the center-right. And so that becomes the terrain of political competition. But the difficulty is that trickle-down doesn't work. And so we enter this era of decades and decades where the benefits of greatly increased productivity all flow to the top. We all know from reading Piketty and others, and the vast majority, bottom 90% or more, see stagnating or declining real incomes for decade after decade after decade. And so those are the sources of it. And it's hegemonic, I think, until the financial crisis, because the claim that the neoliberal order is the only game in town, and proof is not only the collapse of the alternatives, but also we know how to run these economies. We know what we're doing. We know how to run the global financial system. So get with the program. There is no alternative. And that all starts to unravel, not so much just with the financial crisis, but with the response of political economic elites to the financial crisis. Because what the vast majority of them fail to realize is that the way in which the financial crisis, first of all, was completely unpredicted, but then their response basically to suddenly fall back in love with Keynesian remedies, but only for themselves and their buddies, bailing out the banks, restoring the financial markets, recapitalizing the financial sector. And so 2-3 years later, everybody's 401ks are back, the stock market's back, but they largely retain the doctrine, sort of TINA doctrine of austerity for the rest. And so you get in the US more than 20 million people thrown out of their houses in the foreclosure. We get much slower recovery and much worse recovery from the financial crisis. All over Europe, the financial crisis is followed by a 5-year Eurozone crisis. 2012, Merkel and Trichet create the fiscal compact in Europe, which essentially creates a kind of constitutional mandate for austerity. So the elites have failed to see that they can't just carry on as before, because the political legitimacy of this consensus is now in tatters and they carry on regardless. And I think that is what creates the opening for the emergence of far-right parties that are attacking the consensus.
So I think your last comment was sort of starting to bring this in. When you talk about the crisis of democracy, what do you mean and what sort of places are you referring to?
Well, I think that the collapse of the legitimacy of the post-Cold War consensus has two different sources. I think in geoeconomics, as I would call it, it is what we've just been talking about. Not only the financial crisis itself, but then the way in which elites responded to that, which laid them open to anti-system politicians and entrepreneurs who would start attacking that order. But in geopolitics, it starts earlier. It really starts in 2003 with the American invasion of Iraq. Because this is a frontal assault on the idea of the international rule of law, the disappearance, if you like, of the institutions of international politics, for which many today are wringing their hands and blaming the populace, blaming Trump for rejecting the liberal world order. But it really starts with American unilateralism in Iraq. We couldn't get support for that from the UN, so it just did it unilaterally. But it really starts, even there are signs of it, even earlier than that, in 1999, when Bill Clinton bombs Kosovo. He doesn't go to the Security Council because he knows the Russians and Chinese would veto it. So it just becomes a unilateral NATO action in violation of NATO's charter, because nothing happening in Kosovo was a threat to any NATO country. And that becomes a template for how NATO acts in the world thereafter. In 2011, in Libya, toppling the Gaddafi's government. Again, this is nothing to do with the mandate of NATO and the triggering of its Article 5. There's no threat to any NATO country. It's just a unilateral decision of the French, the British, and the Americans that they've decided, for reasons we could go into, but probably take us too far away from today's podcast. They've decided for their own reasons, they think Gaddafi's got to go, and they topple him. So you have all of that, and then the relentless expansion of NATO starts again with Clinton in 1999, adding Poland, the Czech Republic, Hungary. And then in 2004, George W. Bush adds a whole slew of countries basically as a quid pro quo for their nominally signing on to his coalition of the willing in Iraq. And so there's this whole slew of behaviors, if you like, by the U.S.-led West, but it's not restricted to the U.S. by any means, to essentially say, we're so powerful, we can do what we want. And the Russians are price takers. The Chinese are growing very fast, but starting from such a low base that at that time, most people are not thinking that China is a real competitor in the way we do today. And so there's essentially this kind of swashbuckling unilateralism replaces the post-Cold War consensus, and I think feeds into the idea that the strong are going to do what they want and everybody else is just going to have to live with it. So it's in a way the international equivalent of Tina at home. So unilateralism abroad and unilateralism at home, if you like. And I think that it is very much the kind of arrogance behind that, particularly given all of its many failures, disasters that it turned out to be in Afghanistan and Iraq. We just left failed states behind there. We created a failed state in Libya. You know, here we are 15 years later, and there's not even a government that controls the country. In huge fallout from all over North and Africa and the Middle East, in Mali, it greatly aggravated what happened in Syria and so on and so forth. So I think one message of my book is that everybody now is wringing their hands about the nasty things the far right is doing and saying, and there's this huge amnesia and myopia, which has blinded them to their own contributions to the creation of this order.
So part of your book's subtitle is How Politicians Broke Our World. Can you talk about how politicians created or contributed to the global issues we see now? And are there any other groups that are also responsible?
So this raises the question of how important individuals are in politics, the sort of old agent structure problem that philosophers and sociologists have worried about forever. And of course, in many ways, in recent decades, we've de-emphasized the importance of choice and agency, reaction against the kind of great man theory of history and so forth. I think that much of the time, there isn't a lot of scope for agency and choice. People are very constrained by the existing institutions, by the existing ideologies, and by the constellation of interests that are all structural constraints on what politicians can do. And maybe they can have some effect at the margins, but for the most part, they don't have that much impact on what happens. I think the end of the Cold War was one of those situations where that wasn't the case, because all three of those things, institutions, ideologies, and interests, constellation of interests, became fluid in ways that are quite unusual. The whole system of institutions surrounding the Cold War were in question. NATO's raison d'etre had gone away. It was formed to oppose the Soviet Union. There were huge questions about, should it exist at all? Should it expand? If it expanded, should Russia be included? There were a whole lot of questions that we've now forgotten about that were hotly debated at the time, with serious people inside and outside government advocating a whole variety of solutions other than the one that was actually taken, which was the unilateral expansion. So that's a good example. There was the institutions of the liberal international order that FDR and Truman had begun creating after World War II, which had become sort of frozen by the Cold War. There was now a possibility to expand that, to continue that project. And there were people who wanted to do that, and the creation of doctrines like the responsibility to protect, which was adopted as something called the World Summit Doctrine in 2005 by the UN General Assembly, starting to assert itself as a kind of global legislature. That was a first. So there were all kinds of changes in the air being debated, and to some extent, possibilities being explored that nobody would have taken seriously for a second. China joining the WTO. There are all sorts of things like this that would have been anathema even a decade earlier was suddenly on the table. The ideologies were all up for grabs because what did communism mean if these countries, either their economies had collapsed or, as in China and Vietnam, they were adopting market systems in politically communist states? What did the ideology of communism mean? If there was no communism, how should we think about the legitimation of capitalism? And so all of those questions were up for grabs. And then the constellation of interests changed because the Cold War had really solidified political and economic coalitions in ways that suddenly became unstuck. And who were our allies and adversaries going to be? Would Russia join the EU? I mean, that was a question at the time. Many European leaders thought that they should, even British politicians here. So it was a period where the typical constraints were suddenly absent. And so that was where there was great scope for agency. And what my book is about is the choices that were made and the choices that were forgone in that period, in the first 10 or 15 years after the Cold War, and how they have constrained the possibilities into the future. So I think it was a moment of great importance of agency, even though those moments are often fleeting and don't come along that often.
So thinking about this immediate time after the Cold War, you talk about and the actions of political leaders, how responsible are the voters, the people in democratic countries who elected these politicians? Do they have any link to these policies? Did they know it was coming?
So I think most of the evidence, you know, my job description is I'm a political scientist. Most of the evidence about voters is that they are largely retrospective. That voters, they don't actually know much about policy, and there's no particular reason for them to. John Dewey, the political philosopher, famously said, "The person who wears the shoe knows that it pinches and where it pinches and which shoe feels better, but that doesn't mean that he needs to know how to make the shoe. The cobbler makes the shoe." So the idea is a kind of utopian conceit of participatory Democrats and people on the left that every voter should be a kind of miniature policy wonk has never borne any relationship to realities. The overwhelming evidence is that elections tend to be referendums on incumbent governments. And if things are going well and perceived to be going well for voters, they'll by and large re-elect governments. And if they're perceived to be going poorly and are being experienced as going poorly, they'll kick them out. And so I think it's misplaced to sort of blame the voters for electing these leaders. I think the real issue is what were the leaders doing? And the fact that, as I said, both center-left and center-right parties had converged on policies that left the vast majority of voters behind, made them available to be mobilized by politicians, either people who were always anti-system, the sort of Nigel Farages of this world, or the few mainstream politicians who saw what was happening and started to reinvent themselves to ride this wave, such as Boris Johnson, such as Orban, such as Erdogan. They saw that the game was changing, and so they could mobilize support by attacking a status quo that they had been part of. But they were the exception. The vast majority, people like Macron and people like Gordon Brown and people like Obama, for that matter, essentially didn't see that. And so they played into the hands of these mobilizers of anti-system voters. And they were pushing against an open door, if you like, because of the behavior of the mainstream elites. And I think also the evidence from comparative politics is what matters most for the survival of democracy is not the beliefs of voters, but the beliefs of political elites. If you have political elites who are not committed to democratic institutions, that's when you're in real trouble.
I just want to ask a follow-up, if I may. Thinking about that open door you mentioned, which I think is a great metaphor for the rise of populism, what opened that door for populists? Was it the interaction of the global financial crisis with the politics of the previous decade?
The short answer is yes. What the financial crisis, and particularly its aftermath, the way in which the elites responded to the financial crisis, made them vulnerable to populist attack. It's hard for us to think back to the hegemony of the neoliberal view. You know, they were talking about, you know, Alan Greenspan had abolished the business cycle, and the great moderation, Ben Bernanke, was talking about that they really knew what they were doing. It's clear that they weren't. But then when the hit the fan, what did they do? They just borrowed trillions and bailed themselves out. And then, you know, as soon as people started saying, well, what about everybody else? You know, what about all these millions of people who are losing their homes? They started talking about moral hazards. But of course, what bigger moral hazard is there in allowing financial elites and bankers to gamble and then lose and be bailed out by taxpayers? That's the biggest moral hazard of them all. So the obvious hypocrisy of what they were doing was unassailable. And it was, in that sense, it was so easy for the populist elites to come along and attack them. I think Marianne Le Pen is a good example, because you look at her father, who'd run the National Front for decades. He combined racism and Islamophobia and anti-Semitism and all that politics with a right-wing agenda. I mean, he was just basically a Thatcherite. He was for abolishing the income tax. He was for. But if you look at what she does as she takes over the party in 2011, 2012, she reinvents the National Front as not being against the welfare state. She retains all the chauvinism. And so she sees now an opportunity to build out a base by appealing to all of these people who've been left behind. Sure, it's a lot of it's blaming immigrants and so on. But it's also an agenda to talk about the economic effects of what's happened to the vast majority of French workers, to which Hollande is blind, and then, you know, Macron is blind. And we can talk, and we probably should talk about how unrealistic these policies are. But when you're in opposition, that doesn't matter, because there's no referendum on your policies at the next election. But politically, it's a very potent mix. And she's just spent 15 years growing the constituency, and now national rallies in the front of the polls in France by a big margin.
So actually, just to pick up on that point, with National Rally ahead in the polls in France and Reform doing very well in the polls here in the UK, what is the likelihood that those parties will be able to enact their policies in an effective way that will please their voters?
Well, that's a completely different story, because the basic arithmetic of their policies doesn't add up, in the sense that if you want, both the National Rally in France and Farage here are perfect examples of this, because if you want to combine low taxes, zero immigration or as little immigration as possible, and a robust welfare state that is preposterous in countries where the old age dependency ratio is exploding. So if you look at the demography for every country in the OECD except Israel, the declining birth rate is staggering. It's fallen below replacement rate in all of them, and it's falling further and further. And plus, you've, on the other hand, got increased longevity. The combination of those trends is a demographic time bomb, because you've got a shrinking working population supporting a growing retired population. So that's what demographers call the old age dependency ratio, and it's just skyrocketing. And if you look at the projections through 2060, they are terrifying. So what does that mean? An economist or an economic demographer would say, well, it's obvious what it means. It means all these countries need lots of immigration, because they're not going to have economic growth, and they're not going to have people generating the money to pay the pensions and the social security of this retiring population. It's worse in some countries than in others, Japan, South Korea, Italy, somewhat worse than, say, the US or the UK. All these countries are below replacement rate, and all these countries, to some degree, have this problem, and this problem's going to get worse. So if you're choking off immigration, then what have you got left? You've basically got a massive structural fiscal crisis of the state for all of these countries, and you're going to see intergenerational class warfare. Because there's just no way to make the numbers add up. Even if the demographic projections are off by 50%, the problem is still huge. To some degree, we got a foretaste of this with Brexit, with all the talk, oh, once we're gone, you know, we're spending all this money on the NHS and so on and so forth. This is all nonsense. But that's just a symptom of the bigger problem. So the short of it is, if and when these parties get into government, either they'll have to back away from a lot of the stuff, like Meloni in Italy. She's sort of reinventing herself as a kind of go-along pragmatist on a lot of these questions. or they'll just head for fiscal catastrophe. And the only country where you've had leadership that has faced up to this is Spain, where you have bucking all the trends, where you've got a socialist prime minister who's openly pro-immigration. His country's the fastest growing in Europe. Even journals like The Economist attribute a lot of the success of the Spanish economy in the last 5-6 years to its openness to immigration. Even though they have about 20% foreign-born population, which is one of the highest in Europe, they managed to get reelected. I mean, it's a minority government, but they managed to form a government. 2023 election, everybody thought the socialists were going to be decimated because he's pro-immigration, and he did fine. But they are the exception. No other European country where they're openly pro-immigration and are not being decimated electorally. Well, you know, everywhere else, center-right parties, center-left parties are now triangulating after the far right. So, you know, look at the Social Democrats in Denmark. You know, they're heavily anti-immigration. All the mainstream parties are not, just as they, in the post-Cold War period, were all scrambling after the neoliberal consensus, they're now all scrambling after the anti-immigration consensus because they think it's the only way to survive. Whether it's the CDU in Germany or the Social Democrats in Denmark, they're all scrambling. And so Sanchez is the one person going the other way. So it's an interesting counterpoint. But the Spanish economy is probably the best performing economy in Europe. So the big if is, will voters continue to see in enough numbers that they're getting benefits from this? And that's always an open question. If you look at the far right party, Vox in Spain, their numbers are creeping up since the last election. There's still nothing like the AFD in Germany or National Rally in France or what just happened in Portugal, but it's a kind of ongoing natural experiment almost.
A question for you. Have you filled out the ballpark survey yet? It's just 15 minutes, helps us get ready for our 10th anniversary, and if you're lucky, you might win 250 pounds in vouchers.
Moving to a more global view, we've often heard about the decline of America as a global leader for the free democratic world. Do you think this judgment of the US's shift away from democracy is a fair one?
Well, there are two separate questions in what you just said about the decline of the US and then the US shift away from democracy. So we can address them both if you like. I mean, the irony about the decline is that this has been Trump's electoral platform. America's in decline and I'm going to stop it. But virtually everything he's doing is accelerating it because, among other things, his tariffs and all that are a massive gift to China because they are causing China to develop internal markets at a more rapid clip, which they've been wanting to do anyway for the last 15 years, at least anyway, and then to diversify their trade relationships. Dharma's over there this week. Canadians are working on their trade relations with China. Actually, just as in the previous Trump administration, despite everything he did, the U.S. continued to hemorrhage industrial jobs. He didn't bring any back. And there's no sign that he's fighting the last war in spades. And so I would say never count out the U.S. economy. It's still the powerhouse. It's now the AI powerhouse. So I'd never count out the U.S. economy. But as a global leader, it's facing challenges that it hasn't faced since World War II, for sure. And its huge debt being held by foreign countries also makes it vulnerable in obvious ways. So that, I think, the decline question. Now, the American turn away from democracy promotion in the world, I think this goes to the poor choices made by American leaders in the post-Cold War that I write about in my book. Because what has helped the populists' attack on democracy promotion around the world is that it's not the neoliberals in this case, but the neoconservatives. The neoconservatives, particularly George W. Bush, who thought that the way to promote democracy around the world was at the point of a gun. And so they spent 20 years trying to create a democracy in Afghanistan. They spent 10 years or so trying to create a democracy in Iraq. They toppled the Libyan government, believing that this would create democracy in Libya. They were appallingly ignorant about the preconditions for democracy, which are levels of economic growth that are not present in any of those countries, economic diversification that's not present in any of those countries, local elites committed to democracy, which weren't present in any of those countries. no political scientist worth her or his salt would have advised the Bush administration or the Obama administration that it was remotely plausible that they were going to create democracies overnight in those countries. If you really want to engage in democracy promotion around the world, which I think is a worthy goal, the most important things to do are to promote the creation of diversified, inclusive economies. We talk about the oil curse being bad for economies. Oil curse is bad for democracy because basically if the vast majority of revenue that's coming into the government is the only way to get rich, you're not going to let go of the government if you lose an election. So the only places where oil on a vast scale hasn't threatened democracy are countries where the economies were already very diversified, like Norway or Scotland, but where it's the only game in town, the gatekeepers of the oil economy are not going to let go. So you have all the worst indicators for democracy in these countries. And so then you have this quixotic failed efforts to create democracy that all fall on their faces because of the neoconservative conceit. Not only that they could create all these democracies, which they couldn't, but that they would create regimes which would be pro-American, which was an equally absurd fantasy. And nonetheless, they did it. And so it was a mess, a predictable mess. Predicted, by the way, as I discuss in my book, many people were predicting. This is not hindsight. But it again opens the way for the populist assault. In this case, takes the form of America first. Screw the rest of the world. We'll interact only if and how it benefits us. And look what happens when you try and promote democracy. QED, we win, right? So I think just as in the economic sphere, this kind of mindless embrace of neoliberalism without any regard for its failure to deliver for most people. So the embrace of this agenda of with the neocons that went under democracy promotion and pro-Americanism, there was also on the left, the sort of humanitarian intervention crowd, which was a part of what pushed Obama in Libya, was the Samantha Powers of this world, saying we got to go in and get rid of this bad guy without any serious conception of what would follow and this idea that maybe what would follow would be worse. So I think there are parallels there as well.
And you just mentioned the America First ideology. How has the rise of Trump's America First ideology in his first and now second term accelerated or complicated the global rightward turn and the kind of, I guess, the skepticism of democracy? Because a lot of commentators are suggesting that Trump has been undermining democracy in the U.S.
I don't think the problem is that people no longer think democracy is a good idea. I think the people who thought it was a good idea still think it is a good idea, but what they misperceive is they think the far right is destroying the neoliberal international order and democracy at home. And they don't understand that much of what is happening is because of what they've been doing for the last 30 years. And unless they kind of wake up and smell the coffee on that front, this is just going to continue. I mean, the most revealing statistics, just to take the U.S., for example, Trump's two issues were immigration and the economy that got him elected in 2024. If you look at the opinion polls in the U.S., for at least now 8 months, voters have soured on his policies on both, and particularly since ICE is shooting people in Minneapolis and so forth, it's getting even worse. But he's underwater, I mean, big time on both of those fronts. Now, you look at the Democrats, the Democratic leaderships, they're kind of reveling in the schadenfreude of this. But look at the popularity of the Democrats. It's lower today than it was in the early 1990s when Newt Gingrich brought the Republicans back into power for the first time in 40 years in the House and the Senate, controlling both the House and the Senate. So my worry is anyone with a brain in their head could predict that Trump's policies weren't going to work. Of course, they're not going to work. But what is the Democrats' alternative? They are largely waiting for the Republicans to fall on their face, and they can be waiting in the wings, but they are not articulating an inclusive growth model. Where is Project 2030, Project 2029? Where are the blueprints for what they're going to do for the economy? Nothing happening. So I worry that they're still asleep at the switch And we could talk about Starmer's stumbling economy. Look at Starmer. He comes in with the biggest majority in living memory. He's the envy of center-left parties all over the world because he's got this huge majority. He could enact pretty much any policies he wants. He could lose 60 or 70 votes and still be enacting. And you think about how Blair, who knew what he wanted to do, hit the ground running in 1997 with the first 100 days. Starmer's just been stumbling about and, of course, collapsing in polls and so on and so forth. So my great worry is that the mainstream center-left parties have a flat or maybe even downwardly sloping learning curve, with the possible exception of the Spaniards. And so I think that is the most important thing now. They need to understand that and then have a Keynesian-inspired approach to economic management. Of course, it wouldn't be the industrial policies of the 1970s because we're not going back to the 1970s. The challenges are different, and what will produce inclusive growth in this world is something completely different. It's obviously true that bringing back large industrial production is a complete joke, what Trump's talking about doing, for example, the jobs. But all this anti-immigrant sentiment that is so powerful in white-hot politics, the jobs aren't going to immigrants. The jobs are going to AI. The jobs are going to technology. Where is the industrial policy for the 21st century about how we're going to build an economy that's going to benefit most people? There are no blueprints for this. But on the other hand, if you go back to the New Deal, you know, people now think FDR was this big Keynesian. FDR came in 1932, 4 years before Keynes even published his general theory, and he made it up as he went along. It was experimental. They tried some things, they failed. And actually, by 1938, to Keynes' great fury, he responded to a recession with big austerity, which many people think was a part of what led the stumbling collapse in the immediate post-war couple of years. So the New Deal and the social democracies, Britain here, the Attlee government after the war, very much experimental. They tried things and some of them worked and some of them didn't work. And it's obviously going to have to be experimental again because there is no recipe book. But clearly, you need policies that have a realistic prospect of producing economic benefits for the vast majority of voters. Otherwise, why will they support these governments?
And you've been looking to the future. And then my last couple of questions are really about the future of democracy, really. And thinking about you talking about people being asleep at the switch, if things continue as they are and folks stay asleep at the switch, as you say, how do you see democracy evolving in the next few years because of the crisis?
I think it's a story that doesn't end well because without being too histrionic about it, the closest historical parallel is the 1930s. It is the period when you again had massive structural economic changes. It's a period in which many people were facing real economic insecurity. It's a period when positive-sum interactions in the world economy have been replaced by zero-sum interactions. By the way, much of this was predicted by Keynes in the Economic Consequences of the Peace in 1990, which was his polemic against the settlement in Versailles, which he said, you're imposing impossible reparations on Germany that they can't possibly begin to meet and recover economically. And this is going to produce a backlash in Germany. And, you know, you read that book today, it's stunning, the extent to which he predicted what would happen. But he was shouting at the wind, everybody ignored him. And I think that the irony in today's world is after World War II, people had learned that lesson and they didn't want a repeat of that. So we got the Marshall Plan. We got the defeat of Germany, massive investments, like U.S. investments in revitalizing Germany, folding it into the Western Alliance, supporting the EU, all to prevent what had been the great powers from going to war again. Post-Cold War, we did nothing unlike that. The logic would have been, well, to do that after the Cold War, the U.S. should have invested massively in the Russian economic transformation and folded them into new security alliances and so on and so forth. They didn't do it. Instead, we went into this unilateralism that we talked about before, which basically is a zero-sum world. And if you're looking for a recipe for conflict, it's a zero-sum world. People don't see the advantages of collaboration. Yes, the US greatly subsidized European security through NATO, spending most of the money on NATO. But there were benefits to the US from that. It limited nuclear proliferation. It cemented economic relationships. All of that is now in question. And if you've got countries simply looking out for themselves and grabbing any particular advantage that they can, you get possibility of a war over Greenland, for example. And, you know, that's on a small scale, but doesn't have to be on a small scale. And you could see the fracturing of Europe over Ukraine, because Hungarians might make a different deal with the Russians over Poland. It's every person for themselves and not looking for mutual benefits from cooperation. It's kind of off the table. It's a long way around to answering your question, but the 1930s didn't end well because it was a very much a zero-sum world. And now we are heading at full tilt into a zero-sum world again. So it's hard to be optimistic, but that doesn't mean it's hopeless.
To try and finish on a more positive note, how might politicians or civil society as a whole prevent this crisis of democracy from getting worse? And what sort of choices might prove to be the most important in the coming years?
Okay, so I'd say two things in response to that. One is just to elaborate that even if it's hard to see grounds for optimism, that is not hopeless. So imagine you'd been born in 1900 in any European country, and imagine it's now 1946, so you're 46 years old, and somebody said to you, what do you think the future holds for our world? Imagine what you'd lived through. Two world wars, the rise of communism and fascism, the Holocaust, and you'd just come out of a war in which 60 million people had died. You'd probably, if you had democratic sensibilities, and you said, this doesn't look good. If somebody had said, well, actually, we're about to enter four decades of the most amazing economic growth that the world has ever seen, and the most amazing prosperity for the vast majority of population, we're going to have a relatively peaceful international order, certainly compared to the first half of the century. The superpowers are largely going to play out their conflicts in proxy wars in the third world, but we're not going to have wars among the great powers. People would have said, come on. So that is one thing to say, that even if it's hard to be optimistic, it doesn't mean that it's hopeless, and life does have more imagination than us. And so we should be appropriately humble in predicting that we're barreling towards catastrophe. We may be, but it's not obvious. And you've seen these far-right parties on the rise in many places, but on the other hand, they're losing in some places. You mentioned Spain. In the last year, we've had Canadian voters, we've had Australian voters rejecting the far right. It looks like in the Japanese election that's coming up next week, the LDP is going to regain an absolute majority. Maybe they won't, but they're certainly going to do well in the lower house, whereas, you know, even the last two elections, the populist parties in Japan have done well. So it's not like just relentless, all going in the same direction. That said, I would just come back to the central theme, the burden on the captains of industry, on the political elites, on the designers of industrial policy is going to be inclusive growth. I have a paper called It's the Politics Stupid, as a riff off Clinton's It's the Economy Stupid from the 92 election. But the point is, the economy is important, but it's the way the political elites respond to what's going on in the economy that really matters. And so that's the sense in which it's the politics stupid. And the most important thing, you know, the mainstream parties should be doing where they are in power is looking for ways to promote inclusive growth. And I think that is not rocket science. If Albert Hirschman said many decades ago in his little book, A Bias for Hope, that people will support democratic governments if they think they're delivering for them. And I think he was right then and he's right now.
And just before we finish, I'd just like to give you the opportunity to direct our listeners' attention to any recent or upcoming articles or other projects you're working on or have worked on you think they might find to be of interest.
Well, the book is coming out in May, and it's called After the Fall, From the End of History to the Crisis of Democracy, How Politicians Broke Our World. That's rather a long title, which the publishers insisted on. It does tell you what the book's about. Otherwise, I'm broadly working on this same agenda. It's a sort of politics and policies to promote inclusive growth. And I have on my, anybody can go to my website, I have a whole bunch of working papers with various postdocs and other co-authors that put up there all the time. I have a little organization at Yale called the Leitner Program on Effective Democratic Governance. I have some postdocs working with me there. We have periodic workshops and conferences and publications come out of that as well. So look at me online and you will be able to find those things.
Thank you. And we'll provide links to your upcoming book and all those resources in our show notes as well. Just remains me to say, Professor Ian Shapiro, thank you so much for speaking to The Ballpark today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Ian Shapiro is Sterling Professor of Political Science and Global Affairs at Yale University and a current visiting professor at the Phelan U.S. Center. He has written widely and influentially on democracy, justice, and the methods of social inquiry. His research concerns the relations between democracy and the distribution of income, wealth, and risk. And that's it for this episode of The Ballpark. Thanks to Professor Ian Shapiro for joining us in this episode. For more information about the Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. On X and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US, and on LinkedIn, we're at LSE United States. This episode of The Ballpark was produced by Chris Gilson and Evan Fatah. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and like lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. You can email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US. And tell your friends about us. If you'd like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. Helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.
Play ball!